KBOO 90.7 FM on the broadcast dial in Portland, Oregon, USA, and KBOO.FM on the World Wide Web is pleased to present the entire proceedings of the Biodiesel Conference held in Portland, Oregon on October the 23rd. From 12:30 in the afternoon, the opening remarks, through the town hall meeting, which adjourned at 4:15. The only editing has been the silence of a 15-minute break. During intermission, we cut out the silence. This is Glenn Owen for KBOO Public Affairs on the Web.
Hello, I'm Andrea Lewis, the Creative Director for Energy Element. Our mission is to fuel solutions. Energy Element is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting alternative fuels. As a vehicle for innovation, Energy Element energizes the movement away from petroleum through educational and outreach services. We support sustainable markets where the cycle of returns is visible within our community. We have a beginning segment as biofuel introductions. I'm going to be introducing Paul Needham and also to be introducing John blanks at names. Got Don Wysowski. Got on the opposite order. Don Wysowski is an extension soil scientist with Crop and Soil Science Department of Oregon State University, Columbia Basin Agricultural Research Center at Pendleton, Oregon. He's conducting educational program and applied research on soil, water, crop management, and dry land crop systems in the semi-arid Pacific Northwest. The goal of his extension publications and educational meetings is to integrate research results into a whole farm management system. He cooperates and works with the USDA and state agencies to develop and implement public policy on conservation. Since 1987, he has conducted research and developed agronomic recommendations for canola and other new crops. He's worked with producers, extension agents, natural resource conservation services, personnel, agriculture consultants, and soil and water conservation districts to get research informed into the hands of farmers and other users. All activities have been targeted to meet producer needs and to present information that is practical, financially sound, and scientifically credible. His education and research efforts have focused on developing cropping systems that improve farms and resource sustainability. This includes integrated research on tillage, fertility, residue management, rotation crops, and diversification of crop systems. Then following that, we're actually going to have Paul Needham. Paul Needham is a native Oregonian. Paul Needham grew in Lake Oswego and graduated from Oregon State University. He is the principal of Critical Marketing and strategic marketing firms specializing in helping software and sustainable businesses. Paul is a founder and board member of the Sustainable Business Network of Portland. The Sustainable Business Network is an alliance of locally owned independent businesses, community organizations, and individuals. He's working on building a more socially, environmentally, and financially sustainable local economy. In fall 2004, Sustainable Business Network launched the Think Local First marketing campaign, which encourages buying from locally owned independent businesses. Now, almost 300 businesses are participating in the campaign, and underwriting sponsors include Kitchen Caboodle, New Seasons Market, Powell's Books, Rejuvenations, and Storables. More information about Think Local can be found at www.thinklocalportland.org. Thank you very much. Correction. First speaker is actually going to be Mitchell Hartman. Mitchell Hartman is an editor of Reed College's quarterly magazine and was the editor of Oregon Business Magazine from 2001 until earlier this year, September 2005. Prior to moving to Portland with his family in 2001, he lived in Los Angeles, where he was a reporter, editor, and producer for Public Radio's Marketplace program. He has covered business, labor, economic development, energy, and workplace issues at several regional newspapers on the East Coast and has been a foreign reporter for Pacifica News and the BBC in Europe and in the Middle East.
Thanks. It's definitely fun being visionary. For one thing, you get to come to the Expo Center on a Sunday. You get to look at cool cars, listen to country music, get a solar massage, apparently, in the parking lot, which is where I'm going after this. You may remember a few years back, two scientists thought that they had invented the be-all and end-all to answer the Earth's energy needs. It was called cold fusion. When I was a producer at Marketplace Public Radio, we did a little skit to envision this future of a cold fusion-powered world, and I'm going to play it, assuming that the play button works.
Today, we drop in on the Smiley family having breakfast in their cold fusion-powered ranch home in Sunnyvale Estates.
Joan, this coffee is wonderful. Hot the way I like it, not too bitter.
Well, Jim, ever since we fusionized the kitchen like the Joneses next door, it's really hard to make a bad cup of coffee. Why, the coffee maker stores up cold fusion energy right from that jar of water by the faucet.
And when's the last time we paid a Con Ed bill? I'll tell you when. March 23rd, 1989, the day Pons and Fleischman discovered cold fusion. Why, we've saved $2 trillion as a nation on energy since then.
Giving us the money to save Social Security and fix the nation's schools. And do you remember how surprised little Stephanie was when her toy train started to run without the battery inside?
Where is she?
Up on the roof, observing the mist on the mountains through her telescope. You remember the science fair project about global cooling? Here come the kids now. Brandon, honey, please don't play with your Fusion Tendo at the breakfast table.
Oh, Mom.
And did I see you playing by the gasoline pumps over on Fleischman Boulevard yesterday, young man? Those old Exxon stations are dangerous.
What is Exxon? And what is gasoline?
Gasoline, a distilled byproduct of petroleum, like coal and natural gas, now obsolete.
Okay, wouldn't it be lovely if Exxon and gasoline were ancient history? Just imagine it. We could end our dependence on fossil fuels, get to the grocery store, heat our homes, power the entire economy with some earth-shattering invention like cold fusion. Of course, unfortunately, there are no quick and easy fixes, at least not yet, especially not with elected officials running the country who don't even believe global warming is actually happening. And a state legislature in Oregon that seems more often to be beholden to well-connected polluters. What it's going to take to save the planet from our own profligate energy use, our consumption and our carbon emissions, and consider that Americans use 25% of the world's oil, is slow, steady, piecemeal, transitional, interim measures, all adding up to meeting and hopefully exceeding the greenhouse gas reductions called for in the Kyoto protocols. Those protocols, by the way, the Bush administration refuses to adopt, and yet some leaders in this region, our governor and state legislators and city councils and mayors throughout the Pacific Northwest, are trying to achieve them anyway. There's one great idea, one idea that we can do today and tomorrow without waiting for genius scientists and venture capitalists and an actual, real, genuine national energy policy, and that is to put biofuels in our cars and trucks and to build an industry to grow and distill and pump and burn it right here in Oregon. It may not be as glamorous as cold fusion, but you in this room and others around this region are the pioneers, the early adopters, in one of the key global strategies, short-term, to combat global warming. So what are biofuels? I can tell you that they don't smell all that bad, and I know because as a reporter you have to do a lot of weird things. One of them, in my case, has been standing right behind the tailpipe of a car and inhaling deeply. You do all sorts of things as a reporter. There are two main categories, ethanol, made from corn, and biodiesel, made from all sorts of vegetable oils. In Oregon, it would probably be canola. The key is, and Paul Needham, who's going to speak after me, is going to talk about this. They're made from things we can grow and that we do grow right here in Oregon. Depending on just how expensive gasoline gets by the end of this year, Oregonians will send between $3 and $4 billion to oil company CEOs and shareholders, to Saudi sheiks, to the Venezuelan national oil conglomerate. If we could keep even a fraction of that money here, paying farmers for their vegetable oil and distillers for their biodiesel and Kettle Foods for their used potato chip oil, we would just start to begin to rebalance the scales in what is now a terrible imbalance in Oregon's trade relationship with the world. Not to mention, we would strike a decent blow for the environment and for true accounting of the real costs of oil. The $4 billion, of course, that we're going to send abroad to pay for oil this year doesn't pay for the real cost of using fossil fuels. You know, it doesn't pay for invasions and for military occupations in the Persian Gulf. It doesn't pay for spilling and then cleaning up oil in the Gulf of Mexico. It doesn't pay for, begin to pay for melting the polar ice caps. We all know that biodiesel and ethanol aren't the final solution for global warming. They're just a small part of the interim answer. But transitional fuels are crucial. As it's been explained to me, basically, carbon in the atmosphere warms the planet. We need to do two things to stop that. First is simply use less oil. Use hybrid cars, compact cars, use diesel vehicles, trucks or cars that simply use less gas, and they get better gas mileage, and you put less carbon into the environment. Possibly even more important in the long run, we simply need to get less of our carbon from deep, deep down in the earth. Any carbon that we can burn to get around that comes from trees or plants is released into the atmosphere, it's reincorporated into plants, and it's reburned again. It's a small cycle. Pulling new carbon from deep down in the earth, from under Kuwait or under the Siberian tundra, adds new carbon to the environment. Anything we can do, and biodiesel and ethanol are great short-term solutions for that, to stop pulling carbon from deep in the earth, putting it into the atmosphere, and warming the planet is good. I don't want to leave the impression that this can be done fast enough or that it can be done without government. I recently was speaking to an economist at the University of Texas, James Galbraith, who has looked at things like the space program, other national policies of a grand scale. And I asked him, you know, can the market alone generate the changes, the supply chain changes, the technology that will end global warming and turn off the carbon spigot? It was a short answer. He said no. What he pointed out is that the internet didn't come just from entrepreneurs. You know, the polio, eradication of childhood polio didn't come just from drug companies. All of these things need government to get involved. Unfortunately, in Oregon and in the nation, we haven't had a tremendously great track record in the last little while. We have President Bush's energy policy, energy bill, which I've renamed the Fossil Fuel Producers Protection Act. It's got a little bit in there for conservation and technology, but not a lot. In Oregon, the legislators had two great opportunities to strike a blow and push this whole industry forward. There was a biofuels bill that would have promoted biofuels in the state, and there has been a long-term effort to get Oregon to sign up to the low-emission vehicle standards that California has adopted and that Washington will adopt if Oregon adopts. If that happened, we'd have a we'd have a fuel-efficient block of car and truck buyers from British Columbia to Baja California. The biofuels legislation, unfortunately, didn't make it through the legislature. Corporate lobbyists, Associated Oregon Industries, blocked that by trying to put a pollution control tax credit into that bill. The governor never made it to the governor's desk. And the governor has told the Department of Environmental Quality to implement the California low-emission vehicle standards in spite of efforts largely by the auto industry and the car lobbies, the car dealers, lobbyists, to try to block them from doing that. Aside from being here, if you do anything to jumpstart this, I'd say call your legislators, call your lobbyists, and tell them to get off the dime and do both of those things the next chance they get in Oregon. All of that said, Oregon is still an awesome place to do the biofuels thing. And it's a great place to pioneer this effort nationwide and worldwide. Paul Needham is going to join us and tell us why.
As Mitchell's made clear, this truly is a case for thinking globally and acting locally. I've been asked to focus on how acting locally can strengthen the local economy, can in fact create jobs and make for a more livable Oregon and a more livable metro area. The Sustainable Business Network of Portland has been actively involved in the concept of recirculating dollars in order to strengthen the community. The global economy that we've seen develop in the last 50 years and that is accelerating is going in the opposite direction. It used to be that a lot of the trade that occurred within a region. Now, increasingly, products are being shipped throughout the entire world, products which could be produced here and are being replaced by products that are shipped from elsewhere because of advantages, for instance, in labor costs. So we launched the Think Local First campaign, which talks about buying from local merchants, and there are studies that show just buying from local merchants, services and products will recirculate up to three times as many dollars into the local economy, because the local company will tend to buy their CPA services, they will tend to obviously hire more local headquarters staff. So just where you buy something can circulate up to three times as many dollars into the local economy, regardless of whether the product came from here. Obviously, it is even more effective if the product is produced here, the product is processed here, and the product is distributed here. Okay? And that's what we're talking about with biofuels. So one of the reasons that Oregon has a good opportunity is that all of those things can happen here. Let's have a little question. How many people in the audience think that Oregon, either offshore or somewhere in Oregon, has significant oil reserves that can be tapped? We got one guy out of the whole audience here. I've never heard anything about it. I've never heard the oil companies say it. I've heard nobody gearing up to do it, and even if there are some, it's going to have no significant impact. In other words, we're not going to have any amount of oil reserves that will make us independent of what the global oil markets are doing price-wise. All right, let's try it again. Our president and his administration, particularly after the hurricane Katrina and Rita swept in and did damage to the oil refineries down in the Gulf Coast, says it's very important that we build new oil refinery capacity in the United States. So how many people in the audience think that there are going to be oil refineries built in Oregon? We got one. Okay. Different one, by the way. Well, frankly, Oregon is not very friendly to toxic oil refineries, so we're probably not high on the list of places that you want to go pitch it. But economically, since there is no infrastructure here for it, it's not very attractive. So it's highly unlikely that we're going to see Oregon become a major oil-producing or processing state. Right. Given that, if we continue to use oil as we have, and I mean petroleum, then every dollar we spend is going to be, as Mitchell said, shipped out of state. We have a little bit of distribution, but we have no role in the actual product, and we have no role in the actual processing. That said, in 2004, Oregon consumed 1.42 billion gallons of gasoline and 502 million gallons of diesel. So all of that took our money and leaked it out of the region. Okay. Now, we also talked about when you're faced with something that you don't produce and that you're paying heavily for to import, you've got a couple things you can do about it. One is you can reduce your usage of it. For instance, you'll hear some talk today about land use planning and getting denser communities with light rail systems. I came out here on the MAX. I moved downtown from Lake Oswego about 4 years ago. I walked 9 blocks, got on the MAX. I sold my second car. I signed up for flex cars, so when I need a car, I just walk half a block and rent it by the hour. So there's a bunch of things you can do in the metro area that reduce the use of gasoline. The other thing is obviously to find replacement for it, and that's what we're here talking about, biofuels. One of the things that is very doable right now is to replace our use of petroleum products with biofuels. Now, what's exciting is that Oregon does have the ability to create a closed-loop biofuels infrastructure. You know, it's not like we're a desert state. We can't grow canola oil here or canola seed. It's not like we don't have dense metropolitan areas and areas where the distribution is very easily done. And it's not like we don't have a history of environmental activism and independent thinking that make us able to do things that other states won't necessarily do. Okay. And frankly, I should have said that when I talk local, local is as local as makes sense. So sometimes Pacific Northwest region is what you should think about as local. Sometimes it's the state of Oregon. Sometimes it's your local community. Whatever makes sense as to if I can do this here and keep the money here, then that makes sense locally. So it's not like Oregon should say, well, I'll never do anything that helps Washington. This is a region, and certainly regional independence is important to us. Now, you haven't heard me talk a lot about environmental issues. They're there, but really I think the important thing is the opportunity for Oregon to create jobs and create wealth. And what's interesting about this, I told you I took the MAX. You remember that the first attempt to have a north-south MAX line was defeated, and it was defeated primarily because of Vancouver and the rural voters in Oregon saying, what's in it for me, right? And there wasn't anything in it for them. There was no benefit. It benefited globally and benefited in the metropolitan area. Biofuels isn't like that. So we're talking something that both rural and metropolitan area can benefit from, and I mean economically. Now, is there any proof of that? Anybody done anything anywhere? The case that I hear quoted most often is Minnesota. So in 1997, Minnesota passed a law that required all gas sold in the state to be blended with ethanol. The state now produces over 400 million gallons of corn-based ethanol a year. The estimates that are produced in studying the net annual benefit to the state of Minnesota is that it has a net annual benefit of $580 million a year in the state. Okay. As of July 2005, building on that success, they are now requiring that 2% of all diesel sold in the state be biodiesel. And you can guarantee that they're going to produce that biodiesel in Minnesota. Okay? So it's not like some hippy-dippy, enviro-green state like Minnesota is showing us up, but they are. They're doing it for economic reasons. You know, they're doing it because it's good for their farmers and it's good for their ability to control their destiny in the state. We heard our cold fusion presentation. Frankly, I feel somewhat the same way about waiting for hydrogen fuel cell technology to save us. How many people in the audience think within the next 5 years they are going to buy and drive a vehicle powered by a hydrogen fuel cell? Oh, we got a couple. Okay. All right. Most of us think that we could walk out, buy one of these diesel-fueled vehicles, and switch to biodiesel today. So there is a chance that after billions of dollars of investment, hydrogen cells will show up in vehicles in the 5 to 10 year range, and I'm all for it. But biofuels are not one of these technologies that require a major infrastructure change, large capital investments, or technological breakthroughs that are still to come. We're talking things that are purely a will to do it and economics. Now, there are naturally some open questions and there are some economic challenges. So I'm not an expert on this. What I wanted to do was set the tone talking about the importance of what we could do to the local economy and our own ability to control our economy, basically the state of Oregon. In other words, right now, if oil prices fluctuate, since we have no infrastructure and we have no producing capability, the only role we can play in the global petroleum industry is helpless victim. That's our role. That's what we get. On the other hand, if oil prices were to drop dramatically, there's questions of, well, how competitive will biodiesel be able to get? So it's not like we shouldn't look hard at the economics of the biodiesel industry and at what levels it can compete and how much volume has to be able to be introduced in Oregon to make it economical. The speakers on the panels will do a much better job talking to that than I could, but definitely it needs to be discussed. So in closing, the point that I hope I've set the stage for is a discussion of why Oregon is well positioned to use biodiesels to strengthen our economy and to lessen our dependence on forces that we cannot control. As I said, we have all the ingredients here. We simply need the ability to actually do something with them. We need the support of the local government. And we need the support of the entrepreneurs and the people who are actually buying gasoline and diesel now. It's important that it be viewed as an opportunity, not some global do-gooder thing. So if I got nothing across, I hope I got across that this is an opportunity for Oregon to take control of its economy and to create more jobs and create more independence right here. Thank you.
So I wanted to thank first Andrea Lewis, who is the creative director with Energy Element, who organized this event today. Let's thank Andrea.
There are individuals who have really, really made this whole project come together, and some of those individuals have been Kathy Pepper, Sandy Mary, Solar Richard, Grant Remington, Grant Brady, Jim Skinner, Jacobo Boyd, Lauren Fennell, Marlise Franklin, Chris Hagerbaumer, Chris and Pat Foundation, Peter Moulton of Climate Solutions, Bill Ister of the Biodiesel Club. I'd also like to thank our bands, too, the New Iberians, Tarka, Acrodesia, Orco, for which we're going to do a later oil tour from, Albino Bank, Postal Central, Northwest Auto Sports, Rising Phoenix Biofuels, Home Power Magazine, Alder Creek Kayaking, Green Energy Transportation Tour, Acme Stages and Stages Northwest, and I'd also like to thank Kyle Collins for inspiring me every day to do these kinds of projects. So we are now going to have Chris Hagerbaumer, and she's going to be introducing our next panel, and thank you very much for attending.
So how is the sound? Can people in the back of the room hear? Okay. So thank you again to our introductory speakers were Paul Needham with Buy Local and Mitchell Hartman, former editor of the Oregon Business Magazine. And those guys don't have to stay up here on the podium if they don't want to. What I'm going to do is introduce a very distinguished panel of presenters. It's basically the idea is Biofuels 101. Everything you wanted to know about biofuels. We have five speakers, and I'm going to introduce each one, have each one give about a 15-minute presentation, and we're going to take Q&A at the end of that. So if people can just jot down your questions as we go along, because actually the next speaker might answer the very question that you had. The idea is that all day, until about 4 o'clock, there will be speakers. You're welcome to go in and out as you please. Tell other people to come in. But this is the panel if you want to know more about biodiesel and ethanol and what it means to Oregon. Again, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer, and I'm a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We have been working to promote the use and production of biofuels in Oregon. Together with the Oregon Business Association, we performed a biofuels cluster analysis, developing a comprehensive list of the people in Oregon who are stakeholders in this issue, and we identified the needs of what's basically a fledgling industry in Oregon. During the 2005 legislative session, we led an effort to get biofuels legislation adopted that was unsuccessful in 2005, but we expect it to be successful in 2007. And we've also developed what's called the Oregon Biofuels Network, which is basically folks who are interested in moving policy along in the state. If you're interested in that, you can visit www.biofuelsfororegon.org. That's the numeral four, biofuelsfororegon.org. We're also doing some marketing of biodiesel as well. So here you're going to learn about how biofuels help local economies and communities while lowering our impact on the environment. And our first speaker, well, let me tell you the five speakers we have. Brian Jamieson is with Go Biodiesel Cooperative. He'll describe what biodiesel is, what its environmental attributes are, and how to get and use it. Mark Fitz with Star Oil Co. will describe the home uses of biodiesel, for example, as home heating oil. Thomas Endicott of Sequential Biofuels will discuss the emerging biofuels industry in Oregon. Don Wysocki with the Oregon State University's Extension Services will describe agricultural communities' interest in biofuels and discuss what crops can be grown to produce biodiesel. And Chuck Carlson with Cascade Grain will describe what ethanol is, what its environmental attributes are, how it's used today, and how it might be used and produced tomorrow. Again, I'm going to introduce each person individually, and we're going to have PowerPoint presentations. Let's start with Brian Jamieson. Brian Jamieson is the co-founder and president of the board of Portland's Go Biodiesel Cooperative. There's a booth outside. And the web address of Go Biodiesel Cooperative is www.gobiodiesel.org. Brian is an accomplished startup entrepreneur and advocate of sustainable capitalism. Brian started his first business at the age of 14. Today, he operates a commercial biodiesel pump in southeast Portland, owns and manages Bluebird 58, an award-winning sustainable living ecoplex, and also manages the sustainable computer consultancy Open Sorcery, and is also involved in Portland's newsforneighbors.net. In his spare time, he's working on his third book, Power from the People, How to Start Your Own Biodiesel Cooperative. Welcome, Brian Jameson.
Thanks. Hello, everybody. How you doing? I'm Brian Jameson. I am part of the Go Biodiesel Cooperative. We're based out of Portland. And I just want to say this is a fabulous podium, if you haven't noticed. Thank you for bringing that. I'm here today because I'm a petroleum addict. And a few years ago, I decided to try and kick my addiction. And I've been fairly successful with that. Primarily, I use biodiesel. And I'm going to go through a little bit of biodiesel 101. Go ahead and hit the next slide. So what is biodiesel? Biodiesel is really an amazing fuel. I started using it about 4 years ago. And when I first used it, I got into this huge research kick, and I thought, there's got to be something wrong with it. What could be wrong with this fuel? It sounds too good. So I spent about 10 hours looking for what was wrong with it. Couldn't find anything. Put another 10 hours into it. Couldn't find anything wrong with it. Another 10 hours. Still couldn't find anything wrong with it. I'm a skeptic. You should be getting this at this point. The bottom line is I spent about 2 weeks researching, talking to people, trying to find out what was holding people back from using biodiesel. Because every time I looked, I couldn't find anything wrong. So basically the problems that we have today with biodiesel are so small. They're basically people like you need to adopt it. That's the problem. A few other things need to come up, like we need to have increased production. But I'm going to show you today that it's a really incredible fuel, and there's really no issues with it whatsoever. So here's the 21-word description of biodiesel. I think everyone's had time to read that. Want to hit the next slide? Okay. One thing you need to know about, there's a lot of terminology that's thrown around a little bit with biodiesel, and the primary one is about blends. So you need to understand when you go to the pump and you're looking at biodiesel, you're researching it, very frequently it's described as B with a number. The number after it is the percentage of biodiesel that you're getting. The other percentage would be how much petroleum is in it. So B2 is only 2% biodiesel. B20, which is a very frequent blend, 20% biodiesel, and so on. So today, whenever I'm talking about biodiesel, I'm meaning 100% biodiesel. Okay? All right. For me, the number one thing about biodiesel and the most important thing for us is that the emissions do not kill us in the short or the long term. I think that's kind of a big deal. If anyone's ever been behind a big diesel truck, anyone? Yes, okay. You get that really awful, black, noxious, terrible spume coming out of the back. And it's really frightening because it contains all sorts of little particulates that get caught in our lungs and kill us. I don't like that, and I find that biodiesel actually has 94% less of those. If you look at a biodiesel vehicle that's running 100% biodiesel, you don't see any emissions coming out of it whatsoever. That's when you're stomping it on the floor. I mean, nothing comes out in terms of anything visible. And that reflects the fact that there's only a very, very, very small percentage of nasty things in there. It's so safe to breathe that when the EPA did a test on it, they weren't able to eradicate the poor little animals that they were trying to do so with the exhaust. It's really that safe. It's a terrible thing. It has the lowest greenhouse gases of any fuel that we can currently buy. Now, obviously, hydrogen is a completely different issue, and as was pointed out by Paul Needham, you can't use it today even if you wanted to. So we're not going to go into that. We're talking about fuels that you can get today. That's not me talking. That's a study that was done in part with Harvard University and Ford Motor Company, and I think they know what they're talking about when it comes to greenhouse emissions. The worst offender is natural gas, and it goes all the way down the list to 100% biodiesel. And there's several reasons for that. One of the reasons is the carbon cycle, which I'll get into a little bit later. Another important point about it is biodiesel doesn't have sulfur, which you do have when you burn traditional diesel. Sulfur is a really nasty thing. Not only does it smell bad, it's actually very bad for us to breathe. The thing I like about it, of course, is it smells like popcorn or French fries or donuts. It doesn't really smell like fish. If you use fish oil to make it, I actually had a chance to smell some biodiesel that was made from fish oil, and it wasn't bad at all. Okay, so what I was going to talk about before was the greenhouse emissions. And this is sort of a thing that comes out frequently by people. What are their thoughts about this on the CO2 that comes out, which is the main greenhouse gas? Can we hit the next slide? Okay. When you burn biodiesel, you actually do emit a greenhouse gas, CO2. All right, so that does go out into the atmosphere. However, and this is the key point, the CO2 that's emitted from your tailpipe is balanced by the CO2 that was taken in by the plant that was used to create the biodiesel while it was alive. So there's a cycle. Instead of extracting fuel from the ground that's been sitting there for 20 million years, that's been very nicely sat there, we pull this out, we spew it into the atmosphere, it causes problems. Now we have biodiesel, which gives us a nice, sustainable, perfect circle. Okay? Yes. This little last point might be addressed later. I think it's an important point to get across, and people frequently ask about biodiesel and, you know, can we fuel, you know, can we displace all of our petroleum use in the United States with biodiesel today? No, we can't do it because we waste way too much petroleum. But if we were to reduce our petroleum use to a reasonable level and use algae and other technologies to use biodiesel, we could displace all of our petroleum use. So research that. The algae is a really great thing. Okay. The only negative thing that comes out of burning biodiesel is something called NOx. It's frequently confused with laughing gas, but there's nothing really funny about NOx. You get NOx when you burn anything in our atmosphere. Okay? Doesn't matter what you burn, you get NOx out of it. NOx is a precursor to smog. It's one of the components to smog. Okay? It's not really a greenhouse gas. And in fact, there is some ongoing research that may show that NOx actually pulls methane out of the atmosphere, which would make it something that would reduce greenhouse gases. Now, that research is not totally complete, but at least there are some possible positive benefits. However, regardless of the NOx, there is some technologies. There are at least two technologies that are expected to be rolled out in the 2006 or 2007 timeframe that will reduce these NOx emissions down to something very, very small. So this is not something where we're waiting for this breakthrough to make it happen. The technology is out there. They're just trying to work out a few details. The key point to take away from this NOx issue is that it is a very small point on the whole spectrum of biodiesel, okay? The big things about biodiesel that you need to keep in mind are it is really, really safe in terms of emissions, and it's not going to kill us from the things that come out of it. And, of course, we've got the carbon cycle. So, okay. It is actually safe to eat, but it does make a poor salad dressing. There's a story about this. There was a guy who did a world around-the-world trip on a sailboat, and sailboats are very environmentally friendly, and he wanted to have an environmentally friendly fuel along for the times that there's no wind and you need to get somewhere. So having a diesel engine, he chose biodiesel. So he was shipping these 55-gallon drums of biodiesel place to place. Well, he shows up somewhere, it was like Malaysia or something, and he couldn't find his 55-gallon drum of biodiesel. Where is it? So he looked and he looked and he looked, and they tracked it down finally to a cafe where they had been mistakenly using it as salad dressing. For real. It is that safe. You really can't eat it. It's 10 times less toxic than table salt, which, you know, we all know how much salt we eat. It biodegrades faster than sugar, and you can eat it. And there's a guy who runs around, you know, taking tablespoons of it. I do not advise this because it is It does wonderful things to your digestive system. It's a great laxative. So there are better things on the market, though. So if you're looking for that, I wouldn't do that. Okay. Just a quick comparison between the co-products. In other words, what do you get when you make gasoline versus what do you get when you make biodiesel, right? Well, gasoline, we all know, it's completely non-renewable, right? You have to transport it huge distances, at least 500, maybe 10,000 or more miles. The technology is expensive. It causes all sorts of problems. It requires gigantic infrastructures, immense investments in money. And cleanups, and the co-products are Superfund sites, greenhouse effect, war, all sorts of fun stuff like that. So you contrast that with biodiesel, which is just completely on the total opposite spectrum in terms of what you get, right? It's 100% renewable, 100% renewable. Every component of it is renewable, okay? The transportation can be as simple as right on the farm where the fuel is being grown. In fact, if a farmer wanted to grow fuel to use that fuel to power their entire operations, they'd only need to dedicate about 10% of their land to do that. It's a very efficient fuel. So transportation is very, very simple, very, very quick. The technology is incredibly simple to build. The cooperative has built a processor, and believe me, if the cooperative can build a processor, anybody can build a processor. Okay, we're not really highly technical people. Making biodiesel, in fact, is simpler than brewing beer. They're very safe, and they're incredibly small. The co-op's processor, which does about 100 gallons per batch, takes about 10 square feet entirely. It's a very, very small amount of technology that's necessary. And, of course, the co-products, for real, when you make biodiesel, the co-products are soap and water. I'm serious. That's what you get when you make biodiesel. You get biodiesel, soap, and water. In fact, some people don't even use water. And you also get happy farmers, happy local farmers, and as Paul pointed out, local money in the economy, which I think is a pretty big win. Okay, here's the big question that I have for everyone out here, and I want to get a sense. Who thinks biodiesel costs the same or less than gasoline right now? Okay, looks like about 10 people. How many people think it costs more than gasoline per mile? Much more people, about three times more. How many people have no idea? Okay. All right, so I'm not counting 100 people. All right, whatever. All right. The fact of the matter is, you've probably seen this recently. Move on. Biodiesel costs about the same today. And I have a little spreadsheet here that I update on a regular basis, and I'm comparing two vehicles about as apple to apple as you can get here. These are 2005 models of the VW Beetle, the Turbo S, which gets about 23 miles to the gallon, versus the TDI, which gets 31 miles to the gallon in the city. Current costs of gasoline, I'm assuming, are $2.55. Sounds about right, $2.55. Biodiesel, well, at least I get biodiesel for $3.11, something like that. If you look here on the bottom, the costs are 0.0006. And that's, you know, if the one was over there, that would be a dollar. So it's a fraction of a penny per mile more to use biodiesel in this city. A fraction of a cent. A fraction of a fraction. The highway costs are actually cheaper. It's actually a penny cheaper to run biodiesel today on comparable vehicles. Now, I wonder how many people think the price of gasoline is going to go substantially down. Nobody? Okay. Chances are real good that biodiesel is going to stay about the same, and in fact, it might even get cheaper. Like, we hope it's going to get substantially cheaper because more and more people are going to use it, and good people in the Oregon state who are already working on biodiesel and producing biodiesel here are going to sell so much of it, they'll have no choice but to sell it for less. So, that is that. Okay. Now, how hard is it to convert to biodiesel? How hard is it to convert your vehicle to biodiesel? Anyone think it's pretty difficult? How many people think it's hard to convert your vehicle to biodiesel? Oh, the message is getting out. I'm so happy. Okay. Yeah, the question was meaning a diesel or a gasoline car. Yeah. Well, actually, there is a three-step conversion process. And I'll answer your question with that right here. The three-step process is, number one, buy a diesel. If you've already got a diesel, you don't have to do that. Number two, unscrew the fuel cap. Number three, pour in the fuel. You're done. Okay. Moving on. I want to talk a little bit about what you have to do if you have an older vehicle, and then I probably have to roll. So when I'm talking about old, I'm going to say older than 1992. Some people will say older than 1996. That's fine. Say 10 years old or so on your vehicle. There's a couple things that you need to do. If you have any natural rubber fuel line in your fuel hose that has to be replaced, usually it's about that much, which costs about $10 and takes about 10 or 15 minutes with a screwdriver, and that's for a monkey like me to do. I mean, it's a really, really simple operation. So that's with a 10-year-old or more vehicle. That's what you have to do. There's a phone number to find Viton, the proper type of hose, but there's plenty of places you can get that. There's another thing that you have to do if you're going to convert your vehicle, and that's if you have an older vehicle that's been running on the terrible fuel that we have, the dirty, dirty, nasty petroleum fuel that we have here in the United States, you have to change your fuel filter after you convert and you move to anything more than a 20% blend of biodiesel. You have to do that after about 20 hours of engine use. There's no hard and fast rule. And that's because biodiesel will go in and completely clean out your engine system, totally clean it up for you, and the deposits will end up in your fuel filter. So you might need to change your fuel filter if you do that. On a newer vehicle, obviously that's not an issue because you already have a clean fuel system. Okay. The last real issue to consider when you're using biodiesel is how it handles freezing temperatures. Biodiesel begins to gel and turn into a solid around 32 degrees. It doesn't turn completely solid at that point. It really requires a lesser temperature to do that. So a couple of things. If your fuel tank does happen to freeze, there's no harm to the fuel. The fuel that's brought over from the Midwest gets frozen already anyway. It's not an issue. Personally, I haven't had any real problems. The last really wicked winter I had, both of our cars' tanks froze, and we just waited until they thawed out, and everything was fine. There are four solutions, though, to dealing with this weather, so this weather problem. If you're going to, say, Mount Hood or something like that, you're going to want to go to the harder level of things, but if you're just going to stay around here, I mean, how many days per year does it get below freezing here? You know, a couple days a year, it's really not a big deal. So my solution is not to drive when it's freezing. I don't happen to like driving when there's ice on the road anyway. So that's not a big deal. The other thing you can do is just blend in 20 to 50% of traditional diesel. It's already got an anti-gel in it, and it'll take care of you. You can also add anti-gel straight into your tank. You can buy it over the counter at an auto parts store. And the last thing you can do is, if you're going up to Mount Hood all the time or you're really concerned about it, you can add a fuel line, inline fuel heater, and tank heaters. And those are fairly inexpensive to do. Okay, last thing, pitch for the co-op. We're out here. We have a little booth. There's about 90 members in the co-op. We make our own fuel. You're looking at maybe 2 to 4 hours of work in exchange for biodiesel that's produced locally on a team effort at $2.25 a gallon. We may actually be able to get that price down a little bit. It's pretty expensive, I know. And we also make really great fry bread from our biodiesel. If you've ever come to our Earth Day shows, we make fry bread out of biodiesel, and we take the oil and make biodiesel out of it. So, anyway, I think that's everything, and I'm going to turn it over now to Chris. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Next speaker in this panel is Mark Fitz. Mark Fitz has a bachelor's in economics from the University of Alaska in Anchorage, where he focused on petroleum economics. He has worked at Star Oil Co., his family's business, for the past 5 years as an operations manager. Prior to that, he worked as an environmental compliance manager in the military. Earlier in his military career, Mark was a laboratory specialist focusing on quality control for fuels in the lab, as well as an Army fire support specialist. Born and raised right here in North Portland, Mark is in his last year of law school at Lewis and Clark College. Mark launched the biofuels program at Star Oil Co. basically within a month of when he started there. He's very excited about biofuels, and he's going to tell us about the home uses of biodiesel. Welcome, Mark.
I had a presentation, but when migrating it over from Word to PowerPoint this morning, I lost it. So I greatly apologize. You'll have to visualize. I'm going to go through equipment and talk to you. And I also wanted to thank everybody here. For the last 5 years, I've been jousting a biofuels monster. And I'll tell you, it's people like you who actually show up and want to care who are actually going to afford this choice. Because government isn't going to do it for you. You guys actually have to become very aware of what these choices are and then communicate to what your leaders do in their own policies. All right, let's start with it. In this room, heat, it's a very intimate thing. It's what you heat your house with. It's what you actually inhale in your own environment. How many people here heat with electricity? It's the easiest way to outfit a house, so you see a lot of construction that goes up new. It goes up with electricity, but it's extremely expensive to heat with, and you're pulling hydropower, which is actually offsetting coal and natural gas power in other parts of the country. So you got that as your first source. It is the least efficient for BTUs that you'd heat with in your house. Next up, who here heats with actual kerosene? None. It's more popular in agricultural areas. It's also an oil product. Who here heats with natural gas or propane? Ah, very popular in Portland. But once you get outside the city and you get away from actual, you know, supplies, heating oil and, of course, wood and pellet become really popular. Anybody here with wood or pellet? All right. Those are also biomasses, but they're not quite as cool as biodiesel. Now, when you look at it and you look at how you'd actually heat, you've got the different types of fuel which have different BTU contents. BTUs are what you actually look at how dense of energy, what it takes to raise a gallon of water, you know, a degree in temperature. It's how much energy you get from that product. Heat oil has 138,000 BTUs. Those BTUs are the reason a diesel vehicle gets more fuel miles per gallon than a gasoline vehicle or a natural gas vehicle or a propane vehicle. Going down the line, you have biodiesel, which is just slightly less energy dense at 131,000 BTUs. The next up, running up to that, is natural gas. Natural gas has somewhere between 110 and 120 BTUs per therm, which means you get around 20 to 25% more energy in a gallon of biodiesel than you do in a therm of natural gas. And it's safe to move around. No one's house has ever exploded from biodiesel. You also can use it in multiple devices. Moving down the line there, you also have your other biomasses like shelled corn, which is blowing up the Midwest right now. They grow corn. They convert a simple pellet stove, a lot like we convert vehicles here, and they're able to use raw corn that's dried in a pellet stove, and you have your standard hardwoods and wood pellets. Comparing the other biomass products that you produce that are pretty common, the wood, the corn, and the pellets, you're looking at 8,000 BTUs per pound of those biomass products. 8,000 BTUs per pound, when you compare it to the same weight in biodiesel, is 54,000 BTUs. So you get, you know, a third, roughly, the same energy content from the same amount of weight from that biomass. So biodiesel is really kind of an amazing technology when you look at it from that perspective. You get an amount of energy that you really can't duplicate from any other source, and you get to use proven technology that's been around for over 100 years, as biodiesel is what the diesel engine that Rudolf Diesel pioneered was kind of based to run. It's amazing. No millions of dollars of subsidies required. All you have to do is educate yourself and move out there and begin to use a cleaner domestic product. Now, how do you heat with oil? It's kind of convenient. You heat with oil just like you heat with any other fuel. You have to vaporize it, though, to get it to catch on fire, which is a positive thing. It makes it completely safe. Standard heating oil is actually a non-toxic product, unless they put a bunch of bad stuff like sulfur and things like that in it, and benzene and God knows what. But, of course, we have laws now to kind of protect us from refiners from dumping that product into diesel. But diesel is a non-toxic, biodegradable product. Now, I'm not going to drink it. You know, it's definitely not that safe. But either way, you've got that product that you can move around, and it doesn't catch on fire, and it's extremely stable when treated correctly. Biodiesel, even more so. So you have this existing infrastructure that's been proven safe with codes that cities have written up already right out the box, ready to go, and boom, you're in business from alternative fuel. And BTU to BTU, it's going to be cheaper than natural gas, I guarantee, in the next 6 months. You know, when they readjust your natural gas rates, watch. You can convert to heating oil that runs biodiesel, either 100% blend or a 20% blend or some other blend you put together yourself, and it actually will save you money in that conversion paying for the equipment. Now, there are four main ways that you would heat with heating oil or any other heat source, and this is where the cool pictures would have came in. The coolest one, the one that's really tearing up the construction world for high-end construction these days, is what's called a hydronic floor heat system. You take a concrete floor like this. You lay out these, you know, pipes that have essentially water with some other stuff in the water to keep it from having issues in the floor, and you run it through a boiler and on-demand hot water heater system that basically heats that water, and it heats the floor. And in a room like this, where it would cost a lot of money to heat the whole room to get it all equal temperature blowing air around, it actually would heat the bottom 6 feet of it and save you a lot of money and energy. It also makes your house feel completely just even and clean the way the heat is. You know, you don't have a lot of blowing, a lot of dust, a lot of wear and tear on various other appliances as it tries to move it around because it just naturally convects up through the floor. That requires, which would be shown here, on-demand hot water heater or a boiler, which also can do your domestic hot water. It's cool stuff. I geek out on this stuff because it's kind of interesting because a lot of technologies have been coming out the last few years as we begin to adopt in the United States what Asia and Europe have known for a long time because, of course, their oil was never cheap. So, anyways, you got that hydronic floor heat. What's required for conversion? All you got to do if you have an existing heating oil system is change your mind, move directly to biodiesel. If you have other systems, you'd have to go and talk to an actual HVAC consultant, a contractor to come in and set it all up because that's pretty complex. New construction, sometimes it's offered right out the block. Moving down the line, you've got the oldest technology. It's kind of like a wood stove. It's called a pot burner. Pot burners were really popular after World War II. You go to Sears and Montgomery Ward's, and you'd buy them in oil or you'd buy them in wood. Basically, it's a wood stove. An oil one has an oil pot in it. It's extremely simple technology. The carburetor that drives it's over 100 and something years old, you know, probably even 200 years old. And essentially it puts a simple drip of fuel in the bottom of the pot, and it vaporizes it with the existing heat of the unit, and it heats your house just like a wood stove. They also have these in gas and propane, but more popular you see those basic models, your standard wood stove, your pellet stove. Heats with convection, not quite as efficient, but it's still there. And with oil, any oil appliance that's a pot burner across the board can likely run 100% biodiesel, homebrew even if you don't get all the glycerin out of it. It's something you can address right off the bat. Right off the bat, nothing wrong with it. All you got to do is set it up and start burning it. And what's great with these pot burners, too, is because they're so old, they're pretty bulletproof. Occasionally they wear through, but you'll find them on Craigslist. You'll find them in the Nicolats. Come get it, free tank, free pot burner, ready to roll. Next in line, you got your standard forced air system, which most of us are used to. Now, in Portland, something that's extremely common is you'll see what's called an octopus. It's a gigantic monstrosity, big pipes coming out of it. Well, when you see those, I mean, just ask, who in here has lived in a house or seen one of those gigantic furnaces? These are kind of cool. You go back to the 40s and the 50s. Coal and sawdust were the products of choice in Oregon. My grandmother's house, which my father still lives in, had a chute where the coal was dropped off, and they would literally have to shovel it over. Well, the 50s came along, and a few technicians figured something out, and this was the cat's meow. You would pay just a little bit of money, an oil heat technician would come in, they'd take the door off an old wood stove, you know, an old sawdust or a coal stove, and they'd put an oil gun burner on it, which is what sticks out. If anybody has an oil furnace or seen one, it sticks out near the bottom. Well, they just slap that bad boy right there on the bottom of it. The same heat exchanger for the coal and stuff would work for that. And because they were built so thick for wood and coal heat, they still exist today. And if they break, all you're talking about is swapping out that same gun burner, which is an extremely cheap part when you look compared to a full HVAC system. So those right there are around, and they will run a B20 blend, guaranteed, no problem. A modern efficient furnace, you know, any standard furnace that runs oil will run B20. You shouldn't have any issues whatsoever. B99, we have a few brave souls who've gone that route. No one from the National Heat Research Alliance, though, will cop to B99 being a good decision. I'll come back to that, talking about where concerns exist if someone wants to go that route. Then you have one other type of oil heat technology, and it's common for propane, natural gas, and oil heat with these, and it's a direct vent unit. They're extremely inexpensive. You install them against an outlying wall, and they have an exhaust vent that, you know, goes directly out the back wall. Those are really easy and simple to install, and they make them, you know, pour oil, and they can run B20 with no problems whatsoever. Now, moving down the line, what is involved with conversion? With converting to biodiesel, the first thing with B20, the only thing you really have to change is your minds, and you have to be aware of what's going to be coming down the pipe at you when you make this conversion. You'd call up one of the oil heat companies, Star Oil included, who happens to actually handle B20 heating oil on a regular basis. You'd set up a delivery day, or you'd even set yourself up for an automatic keep full where we'd take responsibility to fill your tank up, and we go ahead and top that tank off with B20. If it's empty, you're ready to go with B20. If it's not empty, you're going to have a blend below B20, but that's positive on your first go-around. And here's why. You have a tank. Now, as Brian was nice enough to point out, and I'm sure everyone on the panel will point out, the biggest concern when you go to biodiesel in a car is that you're going to have gums and varnishes in that tank that are going to wash down the stream and end up in the fuel filter. Imagine that issue times 200 to 500 gallons of tank. And some of these tanks are literally over, like, 75 years old. So you have some real buildup in there you have to be aware of with heating oil. So that's the first thing to be aware of. If you go with a smaller quantity of biodiesel blended in it, you're going to clean that up slowly and be able to get out ahead of it. With tanks, okay, because that's the biggest issue with conversion is being aware of your tank. You have two types of heating oil tanks installed. You have a below-ground tank, which is every real estate agent's worst fear, or you have an above-ground tank, which will either be stored alongside the house, in the basement, or someplace out of the way, out of the elements. If you have an above-ground tank, go ahead and go out and look at it. That's all you do. You look at it. No leaks, good to go. Just what you do with standard heating oil. If you have a below-ground tank, you have issues because you likely don't know how old it is. Now, there are oil tanks we've seen out there that we've pulled out of the ground. They're like 80, 90 years old, some of these tanks. Not a single problem with them the way they're installed. There are other ones that go in, and in 10 years, there are holes, and they're leaking, and they're polluting the ground, and it is not a good thing. A lot of times with these tanks, when they install them in the ground, corrosion begins to build up slowly. A few little rocks wear on it, a little bit of rust, a little bit of water on the bottom of the tank work in both directions. When heating oil comes in contact with soil, it makes gunk. That gunk usually seals these tanks. You know, it's not the way you want to fly, but it does happen. If you put biodiesel in that tank, if you went straight to B99, that gunk would be gone, and you now have a leaky tank out of the blue. So you want to be aware of that with the conversion. Moving downstream from the tank in the conversion, you got lines, just like with the car. You want to be aware of what those lines are made of. Now, by code, being what the city requires when these are installed, you don't want anything other than either steel or copper in line on these lines. But some people, doing it themselves, have decided to occasionally use rubber or God knows what in the line. I've never seen one, but I've been told every once in a while that exists. Be aware of that. And another benefit of starting with a lower quantity on your heating oil system, like a B20, is that if that begins to wear, it wears with a wet spot to start with. So you'd come into your basement, just walking through for laundry or whatever, and you'd look over and go, what's that wet spot? I should call my HVAC technician. If you went to B99, you'd come in and go, oh, my God, what's this puddle? You know, and it's usually big. So it's smart to be aware of that. But you got the lines. You're going down the lines there, and you want to use either copper or steel. Steel is preferred, but copper lines, which is pretty industry standard, are what you're going to see. From there, in line, you're going to have a fuel filter someplace in line. Oil industry standard uses what's called a general filter. It's our industry standard. It's proprietary. It's so guys like me can gouge it for $5 over what it really costs to buy the filter only from me. With biodiesel customers and all our customers in general, we've gone to recommending what's called a goldenrod filter, which is very common. In fact, it's your common agricultural filter in an agricultural tank to fuel a tractor with. It's visual. You can see the transparent filter through it. The filter can be picked up at any NAPA, any CarQuest. So you walk past it every so often as you do around your house anyways, and you'll spot if you have serious gunk flowing through your system being caught by that filter. So if it needs to be changed, you'll know it needs to be changed, and you run to any hardware store or parts store, and for $3 or $4 get a swap out for that and take care of it real easy, and you're able to stay apprised of it. So that is recommended but not required for conversion. When you have an actual tune-up, they'll always swap out that filter. You should be good to go in most scenarios. But it's handy to go that little extra mile just so you know that everything's taken care of. Downstream from that, you now have a fuel pump. And with most modern oil systems, some pull fuel and drip it to the gun burner I talked about, which should be on the screen in a big pretty picture, have one line. But most of the modern ones have two lines. They're continually pulling product and moving it back to the furnace or back to the tank. So you're moving this product through your system. Be aware of that because the fuel pump, that's the amount of wear it's going to have if it's constantly moving or not. The one place we would ever expect to see an issue with biodiesel causing wear on any type of heating oil system is in that pump. Those pumps wear out just like all parts and cars and everything else in the world wears out. So just watch for it. Be aware. You know, you have two things with these systems that are extremely simple. You either have fuel or you have fire issues. Either it's out of fuel or it's not lighting. You know, so chances are if you have a problem with it, I've got a full tank, I'm not getting heat, my pump is broken, or I've got some type of igniter issue. So you'd be able to address that. But I'm getting out of there. So that fuel pump is the next in line. Then you go to your actual gun burner. Simple device. Takes fuel, sprays it through a nozzle. That nozzle vaporizes the fuel, and then it's able to catch on fire because heating oil or biodiesel, and by the way, heating oil in the Oregon and Washington market is diesel. It's just got a different ASTM spec to meet spec, but it's diesel. It's vaporized and caught on fire just like biodiesel, and that nozzle is the next part to be aware of. That nozzle could be worn out by biodiesel. My guess is, though, because biodiesel is a superior product to actual standard diesel, it's more lubricous, that it's not going to see the same wear you'd see with diesel, but even still be aware that that's something that needs to be annually checked up.